meeting. Please be seated. The first case before the Southern Panel of the Supreme Court this morning for oral argument is Lord v. Chu, case number 49969. Mr. Echeverria, are you ready to proceed?
Thank you, Justice Arbuzzese, Justice Brinker, Justice Douglas. May it please the Court. Before I begin, may I request to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. This morning, I hope to address four critical issues. First, that the trial court committed error when it denied plaintiff's motion for judgment as a matter of law with respect to plaintiff's theories on vicarious liability, or at least the court committed error when it failed to instruct the jury on those theories. Then I hope to discuss that the court committed error when it failed to rule on whether or not the release was void as a matter of public policy and unenforceable, and then committed further error when the court went ahead and admitted the release into evidence. Then I hope to address the issue with respect to the error the court made in awarding attorney's fees under the facts and circumstances of this offer of judgment. And then I hope to move to the issue of judicial misconduct and why that too warrants reversal of the judgments in favor of Mr. Chu in this case. We make main points in our brief, all of which we believe deserve your attention and their merits. But this morning I'd like to start off
with respect to each of the points you've outlined, Mr. Echeverria. Speaking for myself, there are two areas that I would like you to focus your attention on.
Yes, sir.
With respect to the joint enterprise or joint venture liability, why should a distinction be made between a pecuniary activity and a recreational activity with respect to such an instruction? And with respect to the Renaud case, was the analysis of that case flawed because it seems to discuss implied assumption of the risk when it is applying it to express assumption of the risk doctrines? Should the court revisit it?
Let me address that latter one first. In Renaud, the court was very explicit in saying that to enforce an exculpatory release is basically to find an assumption of risk as a matter of law. And it then said that in order to enforce that, you have to have actual knowledge of the risk assumed. If we then go to Mitsushimi, which then dealt with implied assumption of risk, which was a different animal, as Mitsushimi pointed out. And in the Mitsushimi case, it pointed out that their position on express assumption of risk by virtue of an exculpatory contract has not changed. And Renaud is still good law and should be good law. Because if a release is meant to be as an express assumption of risk, then one must expressly have knowledge or have knowledge of the express and precise risks that one is assuming. So I think Renaud is good law and has stood the test of time. With respect to your first
I guess I wasn't clear on my question.
I misunderstood it.
I think you addressed it appropriately. I just wanted to dive into it one more point. Renaud seems to conflate implied assumption of risk with express assumption of risk doctrines, particularly under later versions of the restatement. And the question is, should the court examine that approach?
I think the court did that in Mitsushimi when it found that the Renaud holding was an express assumption of risk in an exculpatory contract and was a different animal than implied assumption of risk that does not involve an exculpatory contract. And in one case, we're looking at whether there's an exculpatory contract, and in another, we're looking at whether the conduct implied an assumption of risk. So I think there are two distinctions, and I think this court has made those right.
Did the trial court instruct the jury in this case on the implied assumption of risk or the express assumption of risk?
Neither. Just put, as I recall, it just put, and I could be wrong on that because I do not remember that. But
I didn't have a chance to get the instruction before today's argument, so that's why I was going to ask you guys.
I got a few of them, but I don't remember that. I do remember that the trial court put the release into evidence and then asked the jury a question about that release, which in essence, as pointed out in Mitsushima, is what we contend is what caused the error and confusion with that jury when they're presented with the release that, as we've argued, is one, unenforceable as a matter of public policy, and two, did not, by everyone's admission, did not provide actual notice to Mr. Lord of the risk that he was assuming. In fact, it intentionally concealed the risk that he was going to encounter in this game. They purposely and intentionally decided not to put anything about being in the area of the mine at the time of the game, and did not express any of the express risks associated with being in and around abandoned mines.
So your contention is that this would rise to the level of at least gross negligence or willful misconduct, even if an express assumption of risk doctrine applied under contract law?
No. What I'm saying is that this release that failed to tell people that they were going into an abandoned mine area, in the face of public policy in this state to discourage people from going in and around mines because of their very danger, that to enforce this release and permit it into evidence is to encourage those that want to engage in that kind of conduct of going into abandoned mines. If we permit the organizers of that game to allow people and bring people in without telling them what they're encountering, it's an activity that the public policy of the state has spent $1.5 million educating people to stay out of these mines. If we enforce a release that actually allows them to do that and escape liability for violating public policy, that release should be unenforceable. Or otherwise, we just encourage that conduct which the state discourages. So I'm saying, first of all, the release should be unenforceable because it hid from the plaintiffs the risk that he was going to encounter, and failed to disclose the specific risk that he was going to encounter. And it was an activity that the organizers of this game knew was not only dangerous, but knew was against public policy. And they'd had, when the game organizers first encountered that mine in January of 2002, they recognized the risk, they recognized the very hole that Mr. Lord fell into, and indicated they had to squeeze around it to get out the other side. From that point on, they put that mine on the sites for the game, knowing that it had risks, and thereafter, every expert knowledgeable on abandoned mines told them, don't do this, it's dangerous. So now if we'd let them say, well, all right, we've been told it's dangerous, but we can solve that. We can avoid liability by having somebody sign a release without telling them where they're going, without giving them the risks of what they're going to be encountering. And to enforce that release encourages conduct that violates the public policy of the state of Nevada. That's why we argue it's unenforceable. Secondly, under Renaud, our position is that even if this court wants to enforce such a release that violates public policy, this release did not comply with Renaud's instructions that said that the release has to provide actual knowledge of the risk encountered. And in Renaud, the court sent it back to...
Well, I guess that's the point I was trying to get at. That kind of a disclosure appears to be required in implied assumption of risk doctrine, but not necessarily in express release doctrine.
I think Renaud...
That's the distinction. I know Renaud says that. That's the question. Is it necessary in the context of an express release that the risk be disclosed as it would be in the context of an implied release?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think we're not saying that proposition, that it requires actual knowledge. Now here, what's different in this case than we're now, is that in this case, there is no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Ward knew that he was going to encounter an abandoned mine that had associated risks. Whereas in Renaud, the releaser there, Ms. Renaud, knew what she was getting into. She was going to go in the silo. And I see I'm down to 5 minutes.
Well, that's okay. You will add 5 minutes to your argument. We want to get to the other point and give you a chance to comment on those other issues. So you go ahead.
Okay. The other point, do you have any more questions on the release issue?
Unless my colleagues do, I don't.
Then let me move to the issue that you raised about pecuniary necessity for joint enterprise. The case is clearly hold, and we've cited many of them, that a profit motive is not necessary, contrary to what the Mr. Chu raises. That when you have a mutual benefit, or even any pecuniary interest, that's enough of an enterprise to attach liability, vicarious liability, to all the participants. There's the Shook versus Beals case, the airplane case. There's the case where the three men bought a car, and the person that wasn't even there was held liable for an accident caused by one of the joint enterprisees, for want of a better word. And I think a lot of these, as I read these cases, these words, joint venture, joint adventure, joint enterprise, are used pretty loosely. But I think the key in this case is the concert of action that the GDS case has set forth, is what are the requirements for a concert of action. And the first one was that you have a joint agreement to conduct yourselves in a certain manner, and that was done here. And there's no question, and Mr. Chu doesn't dispute, that he was part of a group that got together to organize this game. They spent months doing it. They invested over $40,000 into their project. They charged the fee to participate, and that's a pecuniary interest. But more importantly, what GES says is that if you join to do that, and it's an inherently dangerous activity, or poses a substantial risk of harm, then you are vicariously liable. And it's hard to imagine a fact pattern that could fit more closely into the two tenets that GES laid out for the imposition of vicarious liability. Here we have an admitted joint group getting together to plan an event, spending months on it, and $40,000. It's not like a book club that Mr. Chu argues it's akin to. This was a major venture. Many trips down here to Las Vegas from Washington. And so there's no question that there was a joint.
Where do you draw the line on who is a member of the joint venture? Why would not Mr. Lord also be a member of it in this recreational pursuit?
He had no position in the planning. He had no say in how the game was going to be constructed or what the clues were. He had no financial interest in the investment of this. He was one of the persons to whom he was invited to attend the game. But he had no control over the direction and course and ultimate nature of the game, which is one of the critical factors, is you have the right to control. And in this case...
Well, that would be direct liability, though, not vicarious, necessarily.
No, it would be vicarious to the extent that if you are one of those persons that is engaged in this activity and have the right to control and have an agreement to accomplish a result and then do it in an inherently dangerous fashion with substantial risk, known risk, told risk. They were advised. They didn't even have to guess at it. They were advised that going into this abandoned mine area creates a substantial risk of harm.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. But.
And so it's hard to imagine a fact pattern that can come more squarely within the two requirements of GES to find a concerted action. So I think the court clearly erred after the court found, in fact, that they were doing this for a mutual benefit, that they had formed together to conduct this game. The trial court, in denying Mr. Chu's motion for directed verdict or judgment as a matter of law, and denying it, found all of the essential factors that GDS says you need in order to have that concert of action theory.
Concert of action theory, and looking at the restatement, don't they talk in terms of the tortious activity of the party, in this case, Chu? What was his tortious activity independently?
His tortious activity is this. He was one of the first people in the group to go to the mine, along with Mr. and Mrs. Belfiore and Mr. Shields. He knew that the mine was dangerous, and he said so. He admitted in cross-examination that prior to even the engagement of Mr. Russell, the expert, even prior to that engagement, he recognized that they were dangerous going into this mine. So here's a man that knows that they're about to embark and put people into an area of danger and does nothing about it. And that's negligent. Now, that's in the restatement section, that's enough to bring one within. If we want to go under that conservative action theory, which I think is different than what GDS enunciates, but if under the doubt case where they adopted 867, the restatement on that issue.
But the facts talk in terms of Mr. Chu and the point we're talking about, that Chu was not involved in choosing the mine site as a location or in planning its related clue.
And that's the manual. Because he was involved in that. He was a part of the group. They had a website. They shared information. One of the participants sent out an email that says, look at this site about dangers in mines. It was the State of Nevada website that was sent out. It was posted on their website, on their little file that they kept, where they posted minutes of the meetings. It was known by Mr. Chu, or at least knowable, that they were going to use this mine site and that it had dangers. And the failure to correct that, he has an obligation because he admits that this was a mutual benefit they could decide mutually and they came to mutual agreements. And he took no steps. It's kind of like the case, and I forget the name of it, out of Oregon, that we cite in our brief, where the two guys were drag racing. And they both got held in. And then the one defendant that was not involved in the accident said, wait a minute, I don't belong to this because I quit racing just before the accident. And the court said, no. once this is going and once your progress is going, you can't duck out. And that in essence is what Mr. Chu is trying to do here. He's trying to say, well, wait a minute, I didn't really pay attention to all that. That was somebody else's job. I was just working on the handheld computer deal. But he admits that he knew it was dangerous. And he had the opportunity and information available to him to determine that it was dangerous and failed to take steps to prevent that from happening. He failed to speak out. And so this all got whipped up into this would be a cool place, but we don't want to tell them where they're going because they'll ruin the game.
Was the Rule 50 motion renewed post-trial?
Was it renewed?
Renewed post-trial.
Post-trial? I don't know the answer to that. I will find out.
Find out on the break if you could.
At the break?
Yeah, you have 5 more minutes, I think.
Okay. Should I read there? Any more questions on either of those subjects?
I don't think so, Mr. Echeverria.
Thank you.
Mr. Polsenberg, you ready to proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Dan Polsenberg for the respondent, Chi Chu. Let me address the two issues that we covered today. And let me go to the release issue first, because it is also my alternate reason for affirming. Remember, I originally had a cross appeal in this case, saying that the district court should have granted judgment as a matter of law for us on the release. I dropped the cross appeal voluntarily, thinking it was simply an alternative reason to affirm.
But did you move post judgment on your JMOL motion?
And I'm not sure which 50B motion you'd be talking about. On the release?
Yes.
Joel is checking on the laptop to see if we did, and we'll get back to you. He thinks not. We couldn't move for 50B release.
Because you had prevailed at trial.
We wouldn't be an aggrieved party, yes. Also why we did, why I voluntarily dropped my cross appeal, because I'm not an aggrieved party, so I couldn't go ahead. Let's go ahead with the issues. The release. Renault, I'm going to call it Renault. The Renault case, I think, has taken a beating over the years, although sub silentio. The next year after the decision, after Renault, in Mitsushima versus Sunset Ranch, Justice Stefan went into all the different types of assumption of the risk. And then years later, Justice Hardesty in Turner versus Mandalay talked about the different things. I think the law is much more clear now than it was at the time of the Renault decision. But yes, I think Renault got it wrong, and I do think Mitsushima got it wrong a little bit. We are talking here about express assumption of the risk. Mitsushima Ranch, I don't think Mitsushima versus Sunset Ranch didn't address that issue because it was simply a sign-up sheet. Turner didn't address the issue because there wasn't an actual signed release. There were signs up at the 51 ballpark. Here, as a matter of law, and I would submit it would be Washington law under the release contract, but also I think Nevada should follow the same law.
Was that asserted in the trial court that Washington, the choice of law clause should be applied?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
But I think Nevada should reach the same approach, reach the same decision under its law that Washington would reach, and it all comes from the Tunkel case in California where you consider certain factors. Is this a contract of adhesion? Is this for a necessity versus a recreational activity? And I think under all those circumstances, it was appropriate to have a release. My daughter recently jumped out of a perfectly good airplane. And while I went with her and while she's signing the release, I'm looking at that release. And it is as strong as the release here. It's releasing that. It's making her aware that there could be dangers and that she is releasing them even for their own negligence, in exchange for being able to.
I guess specifically, did this need to say in the release, as they talk about a variety of risks from activities that are part of the game, and they're talking about running, climbing, walking at night, unsupervised, remote, and our steep areas,
yes.
Should they have said mines?
I don't think you have to say every detail.
But this seems to be a big detail.
Well, if you put that detail in, remember this is a complicated game. They're bungee jumping. They're going to prisons. They're snorkeling and scuba diving. If they put all of those details in, really, that they would. Now, plaintiff says that we purposefully concealed. We didn't purposefully conceal.
Staying away with the purposely concealed.
Very good.
He's offered a public policy issue as to mines and Nevada's policy on mines. So if it's going to be in this area with these mines kind of deemed a public danger, shouldn't they have mentioned that you should be aware you're in this area?
No, because what we're simply talking about, Nevada has a number of public policies about a number of things, flooding, mines, streets to walk on.
But this is not a situation where we're talking about the streets or the flooding. We're talking about mines for this
That's because that's what it happened to be. It could have been any of the adventures that we were on. It could have been, it was a general risk. They argue in their brief that we should realize that he was in the dangerous hours. He was sleep deprived. He would make a bad judgment. The risk of the mines was going into a mine. The mine they were supposed to go into was incredible safety precautions involved. The problem here is that Mr. Lord, being sleep deprived, making bad decisions, went off in an entirely different direction, knowingly went off in the wrong direction, became lost, and decided to go into a mine that said no, no, no on it. Now, I realize that also borders on comparative negligence, but it's also the situation, it was the circumstances of the activity itself. My daughter jumping out of the plane, she doesn't know what's going to go wrong. She won't know whether it's somebody forgot to put oil in the engine or the person who's holding her pulls the wrong cord. All she knows is that there are general risks, and she is waiving any cause of action for ordinary negligence for those general risks in exchange for being able to participate in the activity. Otherwise, nobody's going to want to conduct the activity. It's like skiing. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know whether you're going to go over a cliff or whether there's going to be a root sticking out of the ground. You don't have to waive all of the particular risks involved. Just say, this is risky business. And I think that that is sufficient here, and I think the caseload across the country goes our way, and that's why I think it's appropriate to affirm on the alternate.
If you're correct that the release presented a question of law as an express release,
yes,
then what was the purpose of introducing it into evidence and putting it before the jury? What question did that release bear on?
Well, the judge said no, she wasn't going to decide as a matter of fact. Remember, one of the
as a matter of law.
As a matter of law, thank you, Your Honor. One of the things, as counsel pointed out, that Renaud did, says there are fact questions involved on what risks are being assumed. And so following Renaud and Mitsushima, the district court said, I'm going to give it to the jury. I don't know what the jury instruction was on that.
That was going to be my next question. What jury instructions tied to that?
I'm not sure the jury instructions are in the appendix in this case, although they're required to be. I'm not sure that they're in this appendix. I just did a search on my laptop, and I only get the proposed jury instructions in the appendix. So I don't think to give plaintiff.
Well, then counsel, the court would direct parties to supplement the appendix to provide all of the jury instructions by the end of the week.
Very good.
Yeah, I couldn't find them, but.
No, I don't think they're in there. And that goes more to their issue. Certainly doesn't go to my issue because I'm saying, as a matter of law, we should prevail on that. But if it was a question.
Well, and on that point, if I may, Mr. Echevarria argues that prohibition from access to mines is a public policy exception under Mitsushima. What say you as to that point?
I apologize. I was addressing at least parts of that earlier, where I don't think just the fact that there is a program to educate people about the dangers of mines means that it is a public policy saying you can't release it.
Then what are the kinds of public policies you think might be encompassed within the Mitsushima exception to an express waiver?
I would have to consider that.
That's why we have oral argument.
Indeed we do. Also why we have supplemental briefing. But
we might get into that.
And we've set out that recreational activities are not it. Now, see, the only mine they went into wasn't dangerous. There were precautions being taken, and we were checking the area. The only thing you could say that it would violate public policy to be on BLM land that happened to have mines. And the risk there was that somebody would go into a vertical entrance. I don't think we cross into violating any such public policy where even precautions were made as to that. As I was saying, we spray painted the very mine involved here had the number on it. It was a different number. It had no exclamation point on it two or three times. So the public policy that we're talking about would have, in other words, my friend Dan Wake took.
Well, should it be the same type of factors that are discussed in Trunkel?
Yes.
That would lead to a public policy evaluation under Mitsushima.
And I think in the number of factors that Trunkel considers, it takes public policy into account. So yes, I would say.
Well, those factors lead to the public policy determination, I think.
Yes.
And so then the question is, do the Trunkel factors overlay the determination of the public policy exception in Mitsushima? I mean, I'm trying to track our jurisprudence on this subject, which is difficult to do, but raises a question in this case about whether it should be cleaned up, and if so, how.
I think your point is an excellent one. I think Trunkel takes over the entire area and considers public policy as well. And I think the public policy that Trunkel is talking about is where you would have releases for things that you would need, utilities, medical care, those sorts of things. That would violate public policy to say that you'd have to have a release before you could go into an emergency.
I guess the thing that troubles me about the case is that it would seem like these questions would have been matters of law, that the introduction of the release to the jury without some associated instruction seems to me to create a problem in the trial. That's why I think the instructions are important. And maybe if we require you to provide us with the instructions, we should allow you to supplement your briefing and comment on it.
I think Tunkel does cover the area. But 2 points on that. Although I am arguing as a matter of law that we should prevail on the release alone, that's only an alternative argument if I don't prevail on their arguments for reversal. Submitting it to the jury never got to that issue because they found that there couldn't be an error in the instructions that would require reversal. The jury answered questions 1 and 3 saying that Mr. Chu was not negligent, didn't act willfully and wantonly, and never addressed question 7 under the special verdict form as to whether the release was valid. Now, I have some problems in juries not addressing all the issues. I think with a general verdict, I'd be able to argue that we would prevail on the release as well. But clearly, it could not have been error for the judge to submit, reversible error, for the judge to submit this issue to the jury when the jury never addressed it, didn't have to address it to go our way. Let me, in 2.5 minutes, address what we're calling vicarious liability. I don't think it is vicarious liability. I think what we're talking about is joint liability. I think there has to be separate means, there has to be a separate liability on the part of Mr. Chu before he can be found to be jointly liable with the other organizers. Let me explain what I mean, and let me first address the issue that Justice Hardesty asked out of the box. What's the difference between joint enterprise and a joint adventure, and why the pecuniary interest? The reason why is because if you didn't have the pecuniary interest involved, everything would be a joint venture. Everything would be a joint enterprise. My friend, I started telling the story, my friend Dan Waite took 50 Boy Scouts camping the other week. And what would happen then if one of them wandered off in the middle of the night and fell down and was hurt? Without the pecuniary interest, he would be liable. And yes, Justice Pickering, I think you're right in raising the issue that so would every one of the campers be liable because they're all involved. This joint enterprise didn't end at Team Silver. This joint enterprise went on every year where all these people were involved. Sometimes people were organizers, sometimes they were participants. So Mr. Lord would have been involved in the venture as well. Now, they raised 2 cases in. And they raised the Shook case involving an airplane and the Cook case, both from California, involving a car. But in Shook, all of the people in the airplane decided to land at Fort Bragg when they were told not to land at Fort Bragg because it couldn't accommodate the airplane. They were all involved in making the tortious decision. In the Cook case, they all 3 people owned an automobile together, but under California law in 1950, there's a statute that made owners liable. There was individual liability on each case. Justice Douglas, I think you're right under Section 876. In the Malum case, now Malum is taking a beating as well, but Justice Rose pointed out there are 2 parts of Section 876. There's the civil conspiracy and there's the aiding and abetting. To be liable under Part A, you would have to conspire, decide together, to do the tort. And under B, you'd have to know there was a tort being committed and aid and abet. So I think we are conflating, and in this argument, we have conflated.
Go ahead, Mr. Polzenberg. I'll add 5 minutes to your argument. I've done the same. And
thank you, Ryan. I may not need 5 because I'm cooking.
I know there's a risk in adding time to your arguments, but I'll do so anyway. Go ahead, sir.
And I've expressed an opinion on that as well. They're conflating their 3 different theories. They've got joint venture, they've got common duty, and they've got concerted action or concert in action. For a common duty, you need a common duty. The typical example is when you have multiple owners of real estate. Now, each owner of the real estate has a duty to make safer war. So that's not a delegable duty. So you have a common duty. Here there is no common duty. For concert of action, we need under Section 876, you need to decide, everyone, conspire to create, to do the tortious act. The act that we know is either tortious or unreasonably dangerous. We don't have that. And joint enterprise, unless you're going to make camping trips and book clubs all have liability, you need to have that element, which is the pecuniary interest involved. And just about every case since 1965 has required that. The restatement requires it. Prosser requires it. They cite the fourth edition. We cite Prosser and Keaton, the fifth edition. So we're not in a situation there. And unless there are any further questions, I would submit this.
Mr. Echevarria wanted to talk about the offer of judgment and attorney's fees in this case, and I'm sure he'll do that. And I was interested in that subject, so I'd like to hear your point of view before you sit down.
Very good. I think some of the construction of the transcripts in the opening brief has been unfair. I think it's been unfair on all the issues, and certainly on this one. Judge Glass does think out loud, and so she was going through the factors, and they're characterizing it as Judge Glass found for them on all the Beatty versus Thomas factors, and yet awarded fees. I don't think that's an appropriate characterization. I think what the judge did is, under the third and most important factor, found that their failure to accept our offer of judgment was unreasonable and in bad faith. Because under the circumstances, and I've laid out the circumstances in depth in our answering brief, they had $10.5 million in settlements at that point already. They were going to trial against the least culpable of all the defendants. They would have to get, so we are entitled to a $10.5 million offset off the top under NRS 41.141 and NRS Chapter 17. So they would have to, they're looking at liability issues, not just our liability, also their comparative liability. For them to come in and say, well, look, he has extensive damages, and certainly we feel for him, anybody feels. But he's looking at a weak case against Mr. Chu. He's looking at a horrendous comparative negligence situation. And then even if he prevails on those, if we get the offset for comparative negligence, we get another offset for $10.5 million. It really is a case they should not have tried, because we have this, even if we don't win, we have this incredible cushion where they still could recover nothing. This case shouldn't have been tried. And I hesitate to say, but I dare say, that it is greed that caused this case to be tried. And it was an unrealistic decision. And I think Judge Glass's determination on that basis was appropriate toward attorney's fees.
Are there any other questions for counsel? All right. Thank you.
Thanks,
Mr. Posenberg. Mr. Echevarria.
Let me deal with that issue on the reasonableness of the amount and timing of the offer. First of all, Mr. Polsenberg apparently is conceding that Judge Glass found in favor of the plaintiff on the first two issues. Whether the claims were brought in good faith, we quote her in our briefs. She found that they did. The issue is whether or not they were in bad faith in proceeding to trial. She found that they were not. So the only issue, apparently, and Judge Glass held this, that reasonable minds could differ as to whether or not the offers were reasonable in amount and in time. In Beatty, that was the only issue the court looked at. And the court said, well, that's not enough. We've got to send it back to look at the other two issues. So the result is that what Mr. Polsenberg is asking you to do is, in essence, turn Beatty upside down and say that the only factor is whether it's reasonable in amount and time. And that's not the teaching of Beatty.
But is it an exact science that we need two out of three or one out of three, or it's...
I think, as Beatty tells us, that we've got to evaluate all of the factors. Now, the fourth one was whether or not the amount of attorney's fees were reasonable, but before you can even get there.
But in evaluating those factors, we don't stack them up and say two for you, one for this person, and that's how we come up with the decision. Don't we evaluate the factors, and then the court, after evaluating, decides whatever they decide?
I think you're right. But if in a situation where the trial court finds that the plaintiffs were in good faith in bringing their case, and were not in bad faith, or unreasonably, whatever the word was, I forget, in proceeding to trial, then to hold that just because they didn't meet the offer is going to result in an award of attorney's fees when the other two factors are satisfied is a hugely chilling effect. And Beatty teaches us that while the Rule 68 is designed to promote settlements, it also says it is not designed to punish a plaintiff. Now, in this situation, let's look first at the time at the when the offer was made. It was made over a year before the trial. It was made shortly after plaintiffs won two dispositive motions on the issue of the release, on the application of law, because they moved to perform nonconvenience. And incidentally, Mr. Paulsenberg is wrong. The court ruled that she would not apply Washington law, but would apply Nevada law to this case. But in any event, at that time, the plaintiffs had just won two dispositive motions filed by Mr. Chu. They had settled for less than the value of the life, the present value of a life care plan. And so they still had not even under that settlement recovered their full value. Now, sure, plaintiffs recognize risk, but you recognize risk as compared to what the offer is. And in this case, the offer was a total of $300,000 to both plaintiffs in a case that has jury value potential of, I would say, somewhere in the 25 to 30 million range. A blind quadriplegic is a huge catastrophic injury. And what they did in that case, at that stage of the litigation, before expert discovery, before some of the judges' trial rulings, at that stage they said, that's not enough. It was like roughly 4% of the total special damages. It was of the low end, and 1.something% of the special damages on the high end. And that's not unreasonable. And to hold that that's true, that one has to accept an offer in that amount compared to the entire value of the injury, is to then to tell the plaintiff, you have no choice. You've got to settle this case. And that's not the purpose of Rule 68. It's to encourage settlement. So that's my comment on that. Mr. Poltenberg talks about his daughter going on an airplane ride and jumping out of a parachute, and that's exactly our point. She knew when she was getting on that plane she was going to jump out of it. And you know that if something goes wrong, you might die. So she knew the risk she was encountering. And you can imagine what those consequences are. And that's a far different case than this one, where Mr. Lord did not know. One, he didn't even know the dangers of mines, let alone that he was even going into one. So it's a far different thing to evaluate jumping out of an airplane, where we know what we're going to do, and that's the distinction in this case. Every one of those cases that they cite deal with a known situation. I'm going snowmobile riding. I'm going skiing. I'm going to jump out of an airplane. In this case, Mr. Lord was not afforded that opportunity. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions?
Unless you have further questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Echevarria. I would like to say on behalf of the panel and for the benefit of the public who might listen to this case, that the panel has benefited greatly by your briefs and by your oral arguments today from two of the finest and most skilled lawyers in our state, and we appreciate your participation and your input. Ordinarily, we would declare the case submitted. I'm not sure we will do